Rachel has a song for us today. Rude. I'm going to say that right in front of my laptop.
Yeah.
Right in front of my microphone.
You're outnumbered in this apartment, so.
That's true.
That's it. It was just,
well, I also have a song.
That's weird. That's not planned. That was actually unplanned.
I'm in up on Poppy Hill. I can see the city lights. Now we both brought equally relevant.
I don't even know what song you were playing.
It's a Peter Gabriel song called Salisbury Hill, but I replaced Salisbury with Pop. You don't know who Peter... Well, I guess we're not allowed to talk about it then because it's not relevant to the podcast.
I don't know who that is.
If Men at Work had done a cover of Salisbury Hill, I'd be playing it, but...
Star Wars. Transformers. Godzilla. Animation. Whatever else. Robots and etc.
It's Wednesday night. No, it's Tuesday night. And but it's not Wednesday night because I have to work on Wednesday night. But it's Tuesday night.
Womp womp.
This week, that means that it is Starformers Zillimation night.
And it's Athena Crunchy's time. The second we started talking, she's gone.
We had her slurping last week. We'll see if we get her crunching this week. Let's see if I can pick it up here. I'll jack up my audio. We got it. We can go home now.
She's welcome. Eating from her new slow feeder because she's a fatty and she throws up.
Did I already say it's Starformers Zillimation night?
I don't remember. You haven't,
well, it's Starformers.
You haven't grilled me yet about what the podcast is about.
A name so good you can say it twice. Welcome to Rebels and Robots and Etc. Episode 60. Welcome to old age, Rachel. We're
this is our retirement party, actually. This is the last one.
I'm Cameron.
I'm Rachel.
And this is our bi-weekly chat about Star Wars and...
Transformers.
And...
Animation.
And Godzilla.
Anything else we want to talk about.
And whatever else we want. Both. Keyword, both. We're not allowed to talk about Peter Gabriel. I'm not even going to define who he is because you're not interested.
I say one thing.
This week we are starting... I meant to come up with some options. I have one option name that I know you're going to hate for this section
Hot
of the
Cat podcast. Bus Summer.
Well, you know, if we were doing Totoro, that would be good. But we're covering three Ghibli films.
Hot Wolf Goddess
Summer.
And
I was
summer.
Thinking Ghibli... No, wait. What? Is it? Oh, no, I forgot what it was. It was Ghibli Goblin Summer or Goblin Ghibli.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Doesn't make any sense. I'll keep workshopping it. That's my shop this week. And so for the first week of Goblin Ghibli Summer, that is a working title name, we have Rachel's pick.
Miyazaki Summer.
I mean, all three of them are directed by a man with the last name Miyazaki.
Average Studio Ghibli film.
Yeah, I almost said Mayo Miyazaki. Good old ham and mayo cheese sandwich Miyazaki. Hayao Miyazaki and his son Goro. This week is Goro's Miyazaki. His second film from Up on Poppy Hill, which is Rachel's choice. Would you say this is your favorite Studio Ghibli film, or is this like the one you wanted to talk about
the most? It's the one I wanted to talk about the most.
Yes.
It's pretty... I've seen a lot of them, so I have to think.
Yeah,
I'd say it's my favorite.
It's your favorite. All right. And we will be talking about that later on. But first, and also a little tease, this won't necessarily be a reoccurring subject on the podcast, but something that Rachel's passionate about that I've recently finished that I'm now a big fan of is Avatar The Last Airbender.
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing about this is years ago, Cameron was like, I'm never going to watch that show.
And
he's like, I'm never going to watch it.
But it almost... took the place of Transformers in our Wednesday nights. Before we were podcasting, I almost suggested we watch it.
Oh,
and then
man.
We ended up doing Transformers
instead.
That would
have been such a long time. That would have been a long time. I feel like we would have had to do like seasons.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, it's a lot. But we will be just do a quick talk about it just for fun, just because it's fresh in my mind. And maybe we'll do a more extended episode on it in the future.
I asked
when
Cameron
we have
what he thought about it. For finishing and he ghosted me.
I meant to say let's talk about it on the pod. Save it up for on mic. But before we get to those lovely conversation topics, we've got news and recent thoughts. Rachel, you have any news?
I do have news, but I also have some thoughts from last episode. I thought I was thinking about our last episode on the Acolyte, and I thought it was interesting how I feel like our stances about the show switched from beginning to end.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Because at the beginning, I was very enthusiastic. I had a lot of high hopes for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then towards the end, I really could not care less for it.
Yeah.
And then you, on the other hand, now I'm not saying you're super enthusiastic for mm-hmm. it, but at the beginning, I didn't think you were as positively
mm-hmm.
interested about it. But towards the end, you were a lot more invested than I think I expected for you to get, which I thought was kind of interesting on how that went about.
Yeah, I think that's a really accurate observation that we flipped on that. What in those first couple episodes would you say initially hooked you that, and then what? How did it lose you?
I think it was the new characters I was very mm-hmm. interested about. I was interested in seeing how, you know, what exactly happened to the twins, you know, to bring them to where they were. It started off with some of my favorite tropes. Something I really love are like siblings or twins who end up on opposite sides. I don't know. I think there's sure. something pretty heart-wrenching about it. And I think it adds a lot of drama, and I love drama. I think it was there was a lot of interesting intrigue on why Osha had left the Jedi Order.
Mm-hmm.
She seemed to have some friendship with Yord. They knew each other previously.
Yeah.
And so I was interested to see how this coven of witches messing with the dark side would play out in relation to the Jedi. It sure. lost me in how it dragged everything out.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
lost me in how it kind of focused on developing all these relationships. And in my opinion, it killed off all the more interesting characters.
That's totally
outside
fair.
Of Chimer grew on me.
Mm-hmm.
I would not trust my drink with him.
Well, he is the villain of the piece.
But I thought Sol was interesting, but I think it's just with how the way it was written. For me personally, it was how it seemed to just drag everything out. And then I think it was the flipping motivations. Osha did not seem to have a single motivation. She did, and then she didn't.
Yeah, she was a pretty lukewarm character.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Very lukewarm. And then one of my least favorite tropes is the miscommunication trope.
Absolutely.
I totally hate agree. That so
I could not agree
I
more with
you. I hate it so much. It makes me so mad because it takes two sentences to go, I killed your mom because I thought she was going to possess my friend and she turned into a smoke demon. I think that last half of the sentence is very important. Now, I am not opposed to Osha switching sides, but I think the way we spent so long Osha defending her choices, just it really felt like Osha and Mae did just a 180 in the last episode. And at that point, I was like, what was all this? I don't know. I was like, what was the point? But it just for me and for Chimer, who spent the majority of episode 5 trying to kill Mae, was like, I'll just let her go. So like, I'm not saying I was expecting Chimer to slaughter her, but it was kind of like, I guess maybe because he was like, well, I got the stronger sister, so whatever it is what it is. I think a lot of the reveals, I think in the big reveals in the show were too late for me.
Sure.
There'd been just a little bit too much like, almost. And by the time they actually showed up, I was like, okay, I hate being teased.
Sure.
I hate being drawn along for extended periods of time. I don't, it's just like, that's like a me thing. I don't personally like that. So by the time we got to the answers we wanted to know, it was 20 minutes into the last episode. And we've talked about this before. I get disappointed when you hit that point in the show where you go, oh, this is just season 0.5.
Yeah.
This isn't the real story they're wanting to tell.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with all of that. I just do think that the characters grew on me, and I saw what they were going for, and I appreciated it, but I can totally see where you're coming from. On the flip side, I do have a lore question after thinking about all of it. Something, a question, and this
Laurel
kind of...
in it?
Sure. Why not?
Laurel in it.
So a big point early on the show was that one of... A big point of May's mission was not only to get revenge on the Jedi who killed her family, but had been tasked by her master to do it by not using a lightsaber. Ultimately, she ends up doing it against Soul with the Force choke. And...
Osha kills Soul.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, okay. Osha's the one who does the killing. But May had... So Osha fulfills what May had been tasked with doing, which was killing a Jedi without using a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very vaguely alluded to. And then the payoff of that setup in the beginning is Osha Force choking Soul. So my question is, why? What was the point of that? Was the point just to push May to find her power, find her dark side power, whatever it may be? Is it, because I assume this command is coming down from Plagueis. That's obviously a huge assumption. Is it these two Sith, Plagueis? Now, obviously, we're also assuming Plagueis is in league with Chimere.
Mm-hmm.
We don't 100% know what their relationship is like yet.
They were roommates.
We assume they're master and apprentice, but we do not know that for sure yet. But assuming that they are, I assume that this order is coming down from Plagueis. But regardless, was the reason of giving May this command to kill a Jedi without a weapon, was it for her purposes only, or was it they know that there is an ability that the dark side has, but they weren't sure what it is, and they were hoping she would discover it? So my question is the point of this, like, this is the reveal, this is the origin point of the Force choke? Because I don't know if the Force choke, like, in the Old Republic video games, was Force choke an ability? I would assume that it is, but I don't know that.
Gonna be honest, I do not know the answer to your question. I think I have heard just a little bit that maybe it's like an ancient Sith rite. Mm-hmm. It's like a task like they're given, but I'm not quite sure, because it also seems very... I mean, it wouldn't be surprising if there's a Sith trait: kill a Jedi without a weapon. Do it. Mm-hmm. Enter your dark side, Force choke him, lightning, air fry him. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But Mays were very specific. Kill the four Jedi without a weapon that killed your family. So that could, as kind of what you were saying, it could be a situation of trying to unlock
mm-hmm.
the power she has. Because as we see in the show, she's got a lot of anger. She's kind of got the start to it. But, you know, as we see, like, she was able to push Osha back in one of their fights when they were kids.
Yeah.
She's got the anger for it. And like she's got the first steps for it. But I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe it's a thing where she's got a threshold. And maybe that was trying to get past the threshold that Osha was able to pass mm-hmm. with her anger. Like I said, I think one thing that was and kind of frustrating that was drawn out was, why did you leave the Jedi Order? And she was like, I left the Jedi Order because I hated my sister. And I was like, I could have told you that.
Sure.
Probably. I probably could have told you that was the suspicion.
And it's the reason this question came up for me, and those were good answers that you just gave, was just that as I was thinking about it, it's sometimes hard to tell when the Acolyte is just telling its own story and when it's doing prequely things.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are prequely tropes, and one is vaguely alluding to a thing and the audience doesn't think much about it. And then when the thing is revealed, you realize, like Jango Fett being Attack of the Clones. Like, once you get there and there's little Boba, you're like, oh, like, it doesn't mean anything to the narrative. It doesn't mean anything other than the fact that this is a prequel. If this wasn't a prequel, it wouldn't mean anything. But because it is a prequel, it's like, oh, that is, we have just learned the origin of Boba Fett the moment they call him Boba.
Mm-hmm. But things that are easier to do when you're making prequels for something that's already been a sequel.
Yeah.
But... I mean, I guess you could say, like, prequels are like 18, 20 years before
mm-hmm.
the original trilogy. Did I say that right? Yeah, prequels. It's a little bit harder when I think there's a little bit more of a gap and so much. There's still so much unknown between what's going to happen between this 100 years and the Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
There's still a bunch that can happen. Like,
totally.
All these people could die.
Yes.
And we're still going to be like, okay, but, like, for example, what about Palpatine?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to him?
Yeah. No, I agree. Just that question came up for me just because, like, I don't know if this is, if it was just simply setting up the force choke so that it was a dramatic moment, or that it was it just purely exists to emphasize that Osha is the one they were looking for, not May, or that it just exists to draw further parallels between Osha and Anakin.
Maybe. But my guess, because it does exist in the like Old Republic games, which are not technically canon, but I use that move all the time because it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lazy and I hate turn-based combat, but I love the story. Combat stresses me out in games.
But that those are our primary source of knowledge, as far as I know, of that era. So
Old Republic is actually like 5,000 years.
Yes.
It's like 3,000 to 5,000 years before.
Something those video games are like our primary knowledge of like when the Sith were very abundant.
Yes, when they're
not the High Republic era, the Old Republic era. So my question is like, it for lack of knowledge, I could look at this and say, oh, maybe Force Choke never existed before this, and this is the first time it's happening. I don't know that. It's just like a guess, or they forgot it. Like these Plagueis and Chimere know. There is an ability that the Sith can do to kill someone without a lightsaber. We don't know what it is, but there's also a lot of those. For example.
I feel like Plagueis is more trying to figure out how to create life or avoid death. Oh, sure. Because that's what he was trying to do.
Yeah, no, it's most likely... A rite of passage is a really great guess. Yeah. Another note from last week, this is very small, but I did not hear it in the moment. I did not, and I wanted to give you props for a very funny joke, if this was your intention.
That's like 75% of all my jokes on this podcast.
I didn't write down the context. I should have, but I would imagine this is most likely after Saul died, you just muttered rest in pieces, which is very funny in relationship to the Teethies and the Fingies.
Rest in pieces.
I thought that was really funny. I wanted to give you props for that joke.
I was proud of it when I said it. I remember saying it. Rest in pieces.
What news you got?
I actually have quite a bit of news because San Diego Comic-Con is going on right now-ish.
Yes. Well, it's over. But actually, sorry, real fast, I have one more note from last week. I just realized my last note was from last
Cameron,
week.
Cameron, what news do you have?
I forgot. I would be remiss if I did not mention two things because last week we talked about music. Two things. We were talking about Star Wars music, and you said, I started to say it really snarkfully, but I don't want to be that snarky. You said that you didn't know the musical element of Empire Strikes Back very well. I mentioned, very obvious, Imperial March, very important. But my two favorite bits of music, I forgot my two favorite bits of music.
Oh, yeah, I've talked about all of mine. What about yours?
Yoda's theme and Yoda in the Force. Are two
just
incredible pieces. I mean, especially Yoda and the Force is the bit of music that plays whenever Yoda pulls the X-Wing out of the swamp. It's just that moment is amazing.
It's very magical.
It's very much because of the music. Like so many people, it's become a very common observation now that music is very frequently the reason you enjoy Star Wars.
Music is just as important to the storytelling, if you ask me.
And that is one of those pivotal moments. So in discussing that, I totally failed not mentioning those two.
We also like Rey's theme, which is also
so
fresh.
We did talk about that, yeah. But as far as Empire Strikes Back specifically, those two. Anyways.
me when I get the chance to talk about Andor music. Thank you, Nicholas Britell. I owe you so much of my happiness.
Comic-Con news. What do you got?
Yeah, so this is all subject to change because movie dates are never the dates they're told.
Uh-huh.
But... So this is with instead of a grain of salt, like a spoonful of salt, allegedly.
A whole salt shaker.
Some of the movies slated for 2026 include Mandalorian and Grogu, an untitled Star Wars film. I'm not sure what that's about. And Transformers G.I. Joe.
Oh, we got a release date for that.
Not a year.
A year.
Not a date.
Okay.
There's also an Aang the Last
Airbender
movie.
So 2026.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I read about this one as well, which it's relevant now.
I'm not sure what the untitled Star Wars film is, but just about every year there's an untitled Star Wars film that never comes out. The other news that I have...
Sorry, I cut you off of the Aang That's going to be January 2026, I believe.
Oh, shoot. That's early.
It's an animated film. New voice cast, unfortunately. But it will be theatrically released, and it will be set after the show. Like, it's not a retelling.
Oh, yes. It's when they're all adults.
So, cautiously optimistic about that one. I know the original creators are involved.
If they retcon Legend of Korra, I'm cool with that.
Yes.
This is a, for half of this podcast is a Legend of Korra hate podcast. I don't hate Korra. I just am old and set in my ways. And I think that the characters in Avatar: The Last Airbender are perfect in every single way, and they can never make any mistakes ever.
Other than Momo. I hate Momo.
War crimes.
We'll talk about it.
So some other news, a new book trilogy for Star Wars called Star Wars Reign of the Empire is slated for 2025 to start coming out, and it's going to incorporate, it's a trilogy that's going to be set in the immediate aftermath of Revenge of the Sith, after when the Empire first takes over. And it will incorporate elements from the Revenge of the Sith deleted scenes about the beginning of the rebellion, which if you don't know, Padme had a very, pretty large part, Padme, Mon Mothma, and Bail Organa. Yes. Sorry, I forgot his name. I was almost like Alderaan. That's Mr. Alderaan.
John Alderaan.
Yeah. There were many, quite a few deleted scenes of those three characters forming the rebellion. So Padme got a little bit of a sideline and died from sadness. But anyway, so that's exciting. I'm always a big fan of Star Wars books. Don't gotta tell me twice. I have quite a bit of news. I don't know what you got.
No, I don't have any news. Other than probably at the end of the news segment, there's a new Transformers 1 trailer we can briefly talk about.
Ahsoka, the show, has been nominated for 5 Emmys. Outstanding special visual effects in a season or a movie. Outstanding sound editing for a comedy or drama series. Half hour and animation. I find that a very interesting combo. Outstanding prosthetic makeup, outstanding period or fantasy / sci-fi hairstyling, and outstanding fantasy / sci-fi costumes. Which is very interesting. The other news I have, there are 2 prequel books for The Acolyte that have been announced. A Yord and Jekki novel releasing next July 2025. And then a novel set 20 years before that, that seemingly follows Vernestra Rowe and Master Indara. So very interesting.
I think you're going to lose a lot of interest from a lot of people by then. Like, if that book came out right now, I would be interested in reading it. But a year from now, I don't know. That's just my one comment on that. What other news you got?
That's it. I think I forgot something. Books. I predicted that this was going to happen. So one thing that always comes out with the San Diego Comic-Con is that Hasbro always announces their list of upcoming Star Wars figures.
Okay.
I texted Cameron.
This is so good. This made me laugh so hard when you texted this to me.
So upset about this. So I'm looking at the pipeline, and I'm super excited because there are a few things I'm like, ooh. Y'all know me. Let me find out. So POV, you're me, looking at the pipeline for the Black Series. And we're like, okay, so we're getting Peridia Ahsoka from the Ahsoka show. All right, cool, whatever. I'm probably going to wait on that one.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting a deluxe IG-11 figure from The Mandalorian with Grogu carrying. And 2 Anzellans. I think I texted you. I was like, I might spend the $37 for the Anzellans. I'm probably not. We are getting the Imperial Armored Commando from Mandalorian Season 3, which is super cool. I already pre-ordered that one. Some of the other... Vernestra figure. No whip. Lightsaber.
She doesn't have her car with her. No whip. How is she supposed to go around picking up chicks?
And these are the ones that are confirmed to coming out. These are not the ones that have been pipelined for the last year. Like Deidre from Andor that I've been waiting for like 8 months for them to finally announce. They keep saying, I guess she'll show up at some point. Or anything like armored Moff Gideon.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other ones that are going to come down the line are Anakin, Clone Wars Anakin and Rex from Ahsoka. You know, things that from shows that came out over a year ago. Count Naka, the Wookiee from Acolyte. A new clone from Episode 3. Some things from Clone Wars and even some things from Legends. But you know what? Figure is actually getting released now and is order open for pre-order. Basil from the Acolyte. All these figures that I've been waiting for 8 months, and I predicted this. I said they're going to make a figure of him and he's going to be the next peg warmer with all the with the Ewok from Kenobi. Uh-huh. Lando Calrissian from Return of the Jedi. No one wants him. Hasbro, take him back. So
he comes with Pip.
I texted Cameron just a picture of it and said, this is hell.
So crazy.
Like, I'm actually so upset by it because you have shows that have been out for years that we don't have a full cast of, but they're going to get the little rat man a figure. Uh-huh. Anyways, that's all I have to say about that. Any other update is that I finally got my hands on a season one Hunter Black Series figure. Scalpers, suck it.
We know you were all waiting with bated breath.
So my favorite thing is that Hasbro re-released them. And you know, the scalpers who were selling them for like $200 unboxed were like, no, my money. So I got it at a completely normal price. So now my Bad Batch figures are complete for the ones that I want. I will never own a Crosshair figure. Wasted my money. You know, Basil might be up there with Crosshair for me for least favorite characters. That's how much hate I have for that little guy.
That'd be a fun topic. I'm going to write that down. Characters we hate the most out of all of our...
Characters we hate the most.
Topic ideas.
50% of this podcast is a Basil hate club.
So that's the end of news?
Yeah.
So, new Transformers 1 trailer, not particularly different.
I thought it was supposed to be like a different tone, and it wasn't.
Well, it wasn't. I think that's the thing I want to talk about was the tone, is they're playing music.
They're playing music!
Right now, we're seeing the same exact scene from the first trailer, where they're all transforming. It just has more epic music, and I'll play you the music that plays over the final title. So that's like...
That bops. That slaps.
That is reminiscent of the original theme, but not the original theme, right? Am I right?
It's a little more orchestral.
Yeah, but like the horns...
It's the same motif.
Like it's... Is that the same like notes as the original theme?
Yes.
Okay, so
I don't know if it's the same key...
No, but that's something.
Yeah,
like,
same notes.
It's a remix of the original one. Because to me, it sounds like a different song that sounds similar.
It's just a new version.
Okay, and that makes sense. I think that's how you get Transformers fans, and you play.
That's how you get them.
Talking about how important music is.
The other way to get Transformers fans is you put a little box trap with a little Transformers figure in the stick, and when they crawl in, yank the stick out and trap them.
But so
like
this
feral cats.
This more epic, more dramatic music is playing over this trailer with a lot of the same footage. And I think it works a lot less.
Now, I have heard that they've been doing some early screenings, mm-hmm. and I've heard good things.
Also, in my mind, a lot of Transformers fans have very low media literacy. Look, I'm not saying all. I'm a Transformers fan. I'm not. What I'm saying is the kind of people that they would seek out to show this movie to early are probably not very high critical thinking film consumers.
This just in, Cameron thinks Transformers fans are stupid.
Well, you know, I was trying to avoid saying that, but you said it for me.
I'm going to tweet that with no context and watch how fast we get.
I'm just saying that kind of people, I think it's totally.
I don't know. I think it was just like general audiences too.
Super positive, but most likely this happens with every franchise film. They show it to people that they know will like it. And they get the whole objective is to get early buzz, positive early buzz, and positive early Rotten Tomatoes scores. Infamously, There was, I remember specifically, there was a Blair Witch like reboot a few years ago.
Blair Wick.
Yep, it was a combination of John Wick and Blair. No, Blair Witch reboot, and they got, they, you can tell they were ready for it. They were able to get 100% Rotten Tomatoes score very early on, and they were able to get a, an advertisement out that said 100% fresh, and it still ended up being rated fresh. I'm actually going to look and see. This was in 2016. Its final Rotten Tomatoes was 86. But there's an ad that existed the opening weekend that said 100%. So my point is...
That's on marketing.
It's all a gimmick. It's all a objective. And maybe it is good. I would so love to be wrong, but...
I hope you're wrong, too.
I would love to be wrong. But like the first trailer... Well, I didn't love, showed a movie that made sense to me. A very lighthearted, very like Illumination-esque kids movie with a with very like poppy music playing over it and a very silly, lots of jokes, lots of punchlines. Yes. For this one, they're trying to make it seem more dramatic, which would be great, but they still have the same dumb jokes in there that now feel way out of place in the trailer. So if this trailer is way more tonally imbalanced, which feels like a worse movie to me. In addition to that, it opens with showing footage of Megatron and Optimus fighting, which we know that's going to happen, but I think you should be teasing that, not just straight up showing it.
I think my favorite comment that I saw on Instagram so far was the Megatron Optimus Prime divorce is going to impact generations. It's going to impact kids for generations.
Well, I will say the fight does look cool. But
Optimus is so shiny.
Yeah, you, I mean, I feel so like shiny, you man. Really want to like. I mean, none of this is reflective of the movie. We're just, I guess, it's just reflective of advertising. But I feel like you want to like save this stuff for when the like we're now we have a full view of what they by the end of the movie they are in their classic designs. Though we do get a little bit of a taste of Chris Hemsworth doing a little more of a Megatron or Optimus Prime voice.
Your taste.
So it does look good though. Like visually, like the designs look good. It's very clean. It's very easy to watch. That was always what some people said, just give us a Michael Bay movie set entirely on Cybertron. But the issue with the Cybertron or the Bayverse designs
is that it's Michael Bay
and the whole planet looks like the Transformers themselves. So you wouldn't be able to tell what the heck is going on. This is actually very neatly and cleanly designed.
There's a shot in there that looks like there are trees.
Oh yeah. I think we saw that in the last one too. It's the
trees metal.
Yeah, that's the question, is it vegetation or what is it exactly? So this trailer doesn't,
I think we only saw a couple glimpses, I didn't get to see it. Pretty sure that we see Quintessence in this.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like, so I was right, me and probably 6,000 other people who saw the first trailer and went, Quintessence. So I'm guessing they will probably be the big bad, and then the secret big bad is the looming caste system and inequality. And
Society. Systemic racism. Also, is this a flying
Which
train?
Is a plot point in some continuities.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Now I got to find it again.
We've seen flying trains before.
That's what I was going to ask. If
Astro
that's what...
train.
Yeah, but like this is more than... It's like a whole... It's not just like... an engine of a train. It's a train with multiple cars behind it. Now I can't find it though.
It's just like the Disney train, but just floating.
A Disney train,
like the thing that takes you around the park.
I've never been to Disney World.
I've never
Disneyland.
Been to Disney either, but I also know key things about the park, Karen.
Well, I don't. So
it's like a bullet train.
Not that
that floats.
I see, like a monorail.
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for.
Okay, this guy right
Monorail,
here.
Monorail, but no rail, so zero rail.
Is that like a flying train guy, or is he a big snake flying in the air?
I don't know.
I just thought maybe you'd recognize it. It looks like is a train with like track forming in front of it. Like it's not just flying.
It could be, Cameron. I've never been to Cybertron.
I am. But you've seen a lot more Transformers than me. You know a lot more about them.
They have roads.
I'm digging for precedent here.
Okay, lawyer.
Do you want to talk about the joke at the end that you did like? Or do you want me to just play it?
Bumblebee comments. He goes, that's Starscream, that's Soundwave, and that's Shockwave. Which I'm very interested in what this, like, baby Decepticon faction is.
Uh-huh.
But he goes, raise your hand if you have Wave in your name. There's a lot of them around here. I think that's funny. And I will be laughing in the theater.
I do like the kind of, like, cheeky character pointing out characters with their names.
I do not like how wide Bumblebee's mouth gets.
It's an animation style, and I just...
is weird.
Any of the Transformers who don't have, like...
There are bounds.
Faces are look great. The faces, I'm not a huge fan of. But maybe sometimes you get used to stuff. The other thing I want to ask, we get the Transform and Rollout from Optimus Prime, but then we also get from Megatron, Decepticons Rise Up. Is that a pre-existing kind of catchphrase, or is that new?
Yes.
It's pre-existing?
Yes.
I think it's kind of cool for him to have, like, a parallel but different command to shout. Anyways.
Because if you look into the, into some of the continuities with an overbearing caste system and social injustice, very much a rise up against the bourgeoisie. The Autobots work for the bourgeoisie.
The birds, the robot birds.
The birds.
Laser beak.
the one bird.
Oh, also, just a quick, this is such a dumb thing to say, but I can't not say it.
Also, hold
Optimus
on.
Optimus Prime has Chad face. Look at his sunken
cheeks. I have a meme about that at a later time.
Okay, cool.
Not specifically about him, but just like the Chad face in general. I saw some videos and I was crying. the other thing that we see two lady Transformers. We've got Alita one and then Arachnid. So
that name is so on the nose. What, are you kidding? Arachnid?
Airachnid.
Air. Well, that's even dumber. But what is Transformers
Cameron,
not...
Cameron, when he gets a chance to insult women.
50% of my enjoyment of Transformers probably is just the dumb, dumb names.
So basically, my question is, will this movie pass the Bechdel test?
My guess is no.
I would very much like for it to.
Better question, has any Transformers movie ever?
Well, Transformers fans in the 80s did the same thing that Star Wars fans did when they introduced women. So they freaked out.
Yikes. well, let's get on to what's really important today.
Anime.
From Up on Poppy Hill. This is a 2011 Goro directed Studio Ghibli anime film. What's the story, Rachel? Give us a brief synopsis.
So this takes place very quickly in, shoot, was it after the Korean War? It was the Korean War.
Yes. Yep.
Very shortly after the Korean War, and we have Umi, the main female character. I think I should have the name. I'm bad at this. Terrible. Take my
fan card away.
Yeah, take my fan card away. Umi and Shun, who are two friends, they're two students who are attending a school.
If after this analysis, this summary of the plot, someone asked you what's the key thing that she said that you should tune into, and it's the way that she said they're friends, that's the part that this movie's about, and we will talk about it in a second.
So there will be spoilers for this. So this is post-Korean War. Umi runs a bed and breakfast that her grandmother owns while her mom is studying in America. She has two younger siblings, a sister and a brother, and their house, it's not an Airbnb, it's like a border house where you're, when people board, you know, like not quite an Airbnb but staying for extended periods of time, almost like landlords. And she helps run it, like she cooks meals, cares for it, and so that's kind of, as the oldest daughter, that's kind of like her responsibility while mom is gone. Dad is out of the picture. He's dead. He was in the Korean War and he died. Our main character Shun is a boy that goes to her school. They're the same age. And this is a very slice of life movie. Lots of Studio Ghibli films have a lot of like whimsy or some like kind of supernatural aspect to them. This is this is realistic. This is slice of life. One of the main things that ties our characters together is that each day Umi puts up from their house, she puts up ship flags on their flagpole. It's her way of kind of like remembering her dad. She's kind of, you know, kind of hoping maybe he'll come back, even though she knows he won't. And a ship answers her. There's a ship that consistently throws up flags to answer her. I don't know anything about ship flags. I don't know anything about Japanese ship flags, so don't ask me. But that's the thing. So this movie really takes place in a very short amount of time. A couple weeks, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
And so what we have is the main central plot point is that the school has an old building called the Latin Quarter. I don't know why it's called the Latin Quarter. And
it's a this I'll quickly throw out a little bit of I read about this movie. The movie is heavily inspired by French culture. And that was an element of I'm sure Caleb is yelling at us right now listening to this, knowing the answer.
I don't think this could be my favorite movie anymore.
It's a French thing. To put it very simply.
Maybe that explains some of the
Part of Paris, I think. Like a section in Paris.
I don't know.
It's the fifth section.
It's kind of how New Orleans has like the French Quarter.
Yes.
So anyways, back to my synopsis.
I'm answering your question. You said you didn't know, so I'm answering the question. It's where Notre Dame is.
The Latin Quarter is a very old derelict building that the male students really use. They use it for their clubs, and the administration or whatever who owns the school has decided that they're going to tear the building down. The overarching, like, main plot is they're trying to save this building. The students band together to save the building. And along the way, Shun and Umi grow closer. Obviously, like, you know, young love kind of thing. And the more they get to know about each other, the big plot point they learn is that both of their fathers died in the Korean War. And Umi shows a picture of her father with some of his buddies, his war buddies, to Shun. Shun goes home and he has the exact same photo.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important. If it's shown more than once, you got to remember it. The big plot point is that Shun talks to his dad, and it is very obvious that Shun was adopted and his father died in the Korean War. So Shun and Umi come to realizing they hold the same photo, and Shun's adopted father tells him that Umi's father brought baby Shun to him and his wife during the war. And so this plot point that suddenly these two characters are brother and sister, half brother and sister. And so they're thrown into a little bit of a turmoil because they're obviously very fond of each other. And, you know, it's not cool to date your siblings.
Hot take.
It's not cool to date your siblings. So along with them trying to balance saving this whole Latin Quarter, they're suddenly kind of thrown for a loop and not sure how to interact with each other. Shun takes the, I feel like, what is actually a very average boy response. And instead of actually discussing feelings, just ghosts her. And Umi's trying to reach out because he actually makes the connection first. She doesn't think about it at all, which honestly, I can't blame her. I don't think she would make the assumption that her father cheated. She's missing that part of the story. So he finally tells her and, you know, very much like, what do we do now? So they kind of just try to focus on being friends. So they kind of put their energy into saving the Latin Quarter. What ends up happening is they fix it all up, spiffy, brand new, and they go and they literally just go to Tokyo and get a meeting with the contractor. And they're like, hey, we know you want to tear it down. Can you at least come look at it? And the guy's like, yeah, sure, I'll come look at it. They come to take a look at it. One of the other overarching themes is, do we destroy the past in favor of the future?
Mm-hmm.
There's a minor subplot of the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. You know, Japan is wanting to put on a good front for this international event,
yeah,
especially post some certain wars.
collar tug.
Yeah, collar tug. And that is pretty prevalent in all the conversations that a lot of the young boys are having around the school. The old man comes and looks at the Latin Quarter, meanders around like a very typical old man, and makes the decision that the new building he was going to build for the school is just going to go somewhere else. They're going to get to keep the Latin Quarter. So that's like one plot point solved.
Mm-hmm.
Umi and Shun are then summoned away. This is towards the end of the film, where I can't remember who exactly it is. I think Shun's adoptive dad got in contact with someone, and they're like, hey, we have information about your father. So they go. And so the important thing to notice about the photo that they share is there are three men, Shun and Umi's father,
mm-hmm.
and then a third. They go onto a military, it's like a military ship, I don't know, like some probably Imperial Navy ship, and meet with this man, and he actually tells them the truth. So they are not siblings. That is the second, third twist of this movie. They are not actually siblings. What happened was the sailor they're speaking to, this captain, Shun's father, who is the second man in the photo, and then Umi's father were all best friends during the war. Shun's real father, the second friend, when he was born, his mom died in childbirth, and very shortly after Shun's real father died, this second friend. I might have those mixed up. I can't remember if his real father died and then his mother died. Something like that.
Yeah.
I think it was probably the opposite. So Umi's father brings Shun home because he wants to take in his friend's son. He has no one because none of Shun's family can take him in because his parents died. And they said the rest of his family was in Nagasaki. So there was no one to take him in. Umi's parents are unable to take him in. And so that is when Umi's dad takes Shun to his adopted parents. They had just lost a baby and they took in Shun. So they come to realize they are not siblings. They are free to date. And that's really just kind of how it ends. I think there's a lot more to the film than just that synopsis.
Sure.
But that's kind of the big things that happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty simple movie. And I had a note related to something you just said, which is... Oh, I just really quickly wanted to talk about... I was able... So we watched the English dub of it.
Yes.
I did watch a little bit of the Japanese dub. And also I...
You mean sub?
Well, yeah, the original...
Yes.
Original version.
Subtitle and
yeah, it's not dubbed in Japanese. It was recorded. The Japanese version. Huge difference is it does not open with narration. The narration purely exists, one, to establish some things that potentially Americans won't understand. Mostly it describes the situation in the household mm-hmm. and who they all are. Because I think very understandably, most Americans would assume this is a family. And then you would eventually discover, but I think they're afraid Americans tune out really quickly, which is unfortunately true. So they wanted to, but also, if I recall correctly, in the English language opening narration, she kind of explains the theme of the movie. She says something about people being too quick to move on to new things and she wants to hold on. And that's, I think, unfortunately.
I feel like it showcases how Japanese narratives are it's the American dub trying to make a connection on how we've even seen this with Boy and the Heron. I feel like American and Westward storytelling have a very obvious like issue,
yeah,
you know, conflict, yes. Climax, blah blah blah, mm-hmm. goes down, and I feel like that's it's very, you know, very popular storytelling. So I feel like the way non-American movies are set up have a very different narrative way. And so I feel like that was, you know, them trying to get an American audience to understand
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the way that the fact that the movie started off that way, I think it did unfortunately set me off on a bad foot for because conversely, when you watch the original version, it's just some really lovely music, and it does help the original version really does help establish the tone of the slice of life.
I didn't make a comment that the sub was better.
Yes. And I do now realize I think what would be good going forward for us is I think it'd be fun to watch the first half in one and the second half in the other. Like as we're watching the movie, we switch so that we can get a sense of both.
Okay.
Because I don't have the time to watch both, unfortunately. Other note I have here, just to kind of give some more context for the film, it is based off a manga from the 80s, which was specifically a shoujo manga, which translates to like girls comic, which I don't exactly know what that means, but that is the context for the original version of this. The original manga that it's adapted from why it took them so long to make this. They originally considered it the 90s, and it took until the early 2010s, was because they weren't sure if this kind of manga would be good for an adaptation into film.
Stuff for girls. Yeah. No one's going to watch that.
We can talk more about that later. So I don't necessarily have the traditional, our traditional dub L and for this, do you have that?
I have things on why I like the movie.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I don't necessarily have a super strong opinion on the movie. I'm really interested in what you like about the movie, and I'd be interested in just discussing why you chose this movie and what about it sticks out to you from either small details or big details, whatever you want to talk about.
All right, so I think the first thing to get out of the way is this is a thing that I think either makes or breaks the movie for people who watch it. It is the siblings plot point. It is the dating or siblings plot point. I think that makes or breaks it for a lot of people. That did not break it for me. I actually remember the first time I saw it, I think I watched the subbed first. I remember watching it for the first time and actually being gutted. Because
at what point?
When it starts to kind of do the reveal. Honestly, like watching it, when Shun goes home and has the same photo and you find out he's adopted, and you're like, oh no. And then when it's quote unquote confirmed, when his adoptive dad tells him Umi's father brought him there alone, he didn't go with his wife or anything. I remember that actually kind of gutted me because I think I'm viewing this as a girl. I think if I were in Umi's, shoes, the guy that they're like 13, but you know, it's also the 60s. They're probably like, 4 years away from getting married anyways? 4 or 5 years, depending. Well, maybe not. I don't know. People got married a little bit younger around then, I think. Maybe not that too much younger. Anyways, all that to say, that would be pretty gut-wrenching to be like, what do you mean we're siblings? But also with the connotation of, holy crap, dad cheated while he was at war. That, I think, has a lot of weight to it. Because she's idolized her dad, and he's dead. It's not like he's around to answer this question. He is, what else are you to assume? You're the same age. Your dad cheated on your mom before you're born. That's gut-wrenching. So that is like the make or break plot point for it. The reason I like this film so much, and I'm going to talk about the things I like about it specifically, I really like Ghibli films that are slice of life. The whimsical ones are fun.
Yeah.
But I think there's something very... I love storytelling in the real world as well. This is why I like From Up on Poppy Hill. This is also why I love, why I like When Marnie Was There, which was my second choice for what we could have watched. It has a little bit more whimsical, a little bit more maybe magic in it. But I really love when the stories focus on real people. Not that like the people in Totoro aren't real. But I think I just like it. It's easy to watch. I really like films that you can like sit down and watch and just kind of like take it face value sometimes. I like evaluating things. I think this one just hit right and where I was able to get invested in this film personally without having to think too much about it. But I kind of like this. I was talking about things I like. I really like movies about humans uniting together. Mm. I think we need more of that personally instead of, you know, so much focus about division. And I think it's very interesting to kind of see how in this post-Korean War, post-World War II, because at this point, Japan is still recovering from World War II. Like, in the 60s, barely any time has passed, maybe 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so you have this kind of like this next generation of kids who were born, you know, after the war. And so they have not quite had the firsthand experience outside of maybe the Korean War, which was showing my American education was not fought on Japanese soil. So they're, you know, not as versed or traumatized that the older generations have when it comes to this area. So this overarching plot of, well, we don't want to get rid of our past, you know, just for the future, especially like with that Latin quarter taking up that area and them fighting against the older generations who are like, yeah, just tear it down. I think you see a very interesting age gap of younger generations who want to hold on to their culture and their past, and the older generation where it might be a little, where it might be quite painful to do so, are, you know, more likely to, yeah, let's move on in favor of progress. Let's move on. Let's not think about it. So I love that the story of this younger generation, like trying to start their own path, but they don't want to completely disregard everything that's come before them. They're seeing the importance. This is our history and let's hold on to it. Let's not just tear it down to make way for something new and shiny. I also think it's kind of like a coming of age film a little bit in a way. I like stories and narratives about kids finding their own way in a tumultuous world, in a world where maybe there are certain societal expectations on them or certain ways they should be led to believe, breaking out of those older traditions and making their own new ones. I just think that's very, I love that. And I think there's also something very precious about the loyalty of friendship that transcends generations. Mm. I'm about to get personal. So we see this with Umi and Shun. Their fathers were best friends who both met tragic ends. They were best buddies. We even see this when they meet up with the third friend who recognizes them because they look like their fathers. He points them. Grant, he probably knew they were coming. Pinpoints them. He's like, you're so-and-so's son and you're so-and-so's daughter. And he gets emotional talking about his friends to these children who have never met his friends, their fathers. And I have a bit of a personal connection to that. Not in that my father is dead. He's very much alive. But I like that because I can see that in my own life. So one of my best friends, we lived together in college at the same place that our fathers lived in. They roomed together. They lived together for those couple years. They were roommates. My dad is roommates with a lot of guys who I also know their children. But I think there's something very human and very precious when people who are friends, that friendship passes down to their own kids. I think there's something very human about that loyalty to, you know, understanding and respecting, like, you know, not only were our parents friends, but we are also friends. I think there's something very warm about that connection, and just like kind of like the love that humans have for each other that can transcend generations. So it's kind of short, but like those are like the big reasons I really like the film.
Yeah, I can totally respect that. I had not really fully appreciated till as you were kind of building up to that point, I realized it myself. It is interesting that you have these two young people who, up until the events of this film, had no direct connection, mm-hmm. naturally became friends, naturally were attracted to each other, and couldn't really explain why. I think they're both kind of caught off guard because she's initially, like, she's like, as soon as she sees him, she's attracted to him, and then immediately kind of off-put by mm-hmm. his kind of big personality.
Oh, and that's the other thing, kind of a plot point that was kind of, it's kind of like hinted at, because she tells him, she's like, I think I've put up these flags and you've been answering. I think my dad sent you to me. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of gets a little muddied up with them finding out they might be brother and sister.
Yeah.
Because then you have this interesting, sorry not to interrupt, you have this interesting, I think, turmoil that she's going to where she thinks this boy has been sent to her by her dad. And then the aspect of, oh, shoot, is this because he's actually my brother? Mm. Does he remind me of my dad? Or because he's my brother, is this something from my dad sending me for my own game? Sure. So all of that kind of like aspect too.
So I think that is an interesting component. I even am not, like, I was initially like confounded by the element of them going back and forth as to whether they were actually siblings or not and whether they were allowed to be attracted to each other romantically. But that was, you know, that's, I think, engaging. I think the whole, I mean, I feel like at the center of this movie is the Latin Quarter bunks are full of personality, are
yes,
visually excellent designed.
The side characters are funny.
It's just like anytime we go back there, the movie's fully alive because mm-hmm. it's visually appealing.
There's a lot of philosophy jokes, which I really got a kick out of because of our friend Caleb.
You know, the absolutely classic boys versus girls, but then it's not versus anymore. It's boys and girls working together. The girls
it's
come
the
over.
Young generation against and, the old people.
Yeah, the girls come over and they work with the boys to totally clean the house. They clean it up. One of the funniest moments in the movie is when one of the boys balances on a ladder to clean the
Wired chandelier.
Yeah, and like everyone claps. Everyone's like, I think there's a cool sense of community in this movie. I love all that stuff. I mean, slice of life is very accurate. I think when the movie is being a slice of life movie, I think it has a lot of personality that I enjoy. On contrast, I think what the movie loses me is when it tries to have a plot. Is it has this narrative about the two main characters, and it builds towards this moment at the end where they finally get all the information, mm-hmm. and then it just ends.
Yeah, the ending is a little jarring.
And structure and rhythm and pacing is so important to a movie. And I'm personally such a sucker for the final moment of a movie. Like, there are movies with, like, so-so final moments that can, if it's been really good up to that point, it can survive. But if your last movie just leaves the audience confused... It's not like a murder mystery. It's not like a Shyamalan film. It's not like, oh, you're going to figure out and put it together. No, it's literally like, hold on.
I guess the movie's over.
Yeah, it just ends. And again, that could work really well in a slice of life movie. You know, one of my, I'm going to totally go off the rails here just for a second to make a point. There's a really excellent Coen Brothers movie called Hail Caesar, which is like almost literally just about 2 days in the life of this film studio. And it just ends because it's kind of like the movie has a timer on it. We're not going to go past this point. There are unresolved plot points. There are characters who don't come back. And for me, that works because the movie is literally just this very short. Like, we're just going to drop in and leave. But with this, the movie is building towards this piece of information. And for me, it draws attention away from what was good about the movie. The movie had these strong strengths, and it's a bummer for me that it felt the need to end on the one. It doesn't feel like it ends on an emotional point. It feels like it ends on exposition.
I'm curious how the anime plays out, if there's like mm-hmm. extra books after this.
The manga.
And this is where they, yeah, the manga. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is where they had to stop it.
Yeah. I think that is possible. I think that is, you can argue, well, it's a slice of life movie and we're going to have to leave eventually. We're keeping it short. It doesn't leave a bad taste in my mouth. It just makes me feel like this movie needs to have a really, I feel like a movie like this does need to have a strong emotional end. Mm. And it almost lacks that. Like, honestly, like, I feel like a moment that you maybe you could end on is them walking together in Paris. That it's beautifully
animated. Paris.
Oh, sorry, not Paris. Tokyo. Tokyo.
Paris.
Well, you forgot the whole sequence where they go off to France fight in the war. The war that was happening in Paris in 1963. They have to go warn them about the 2024 Paris Olympics.
They have to warn them about the effects of smoking.
No, they know. They just keep smoking.
They know.
But like the moment where they're just walking together, like that's an excellent just moment. And it's beautifully animated, and it's very simple. It's understated. I guess that's why I don't like about the ending, is it's too many words that don't really accomplish much. But there are other moments. Like I really enjoyed the moment where I think she forgot to get some fish, or since she has to make dinner, she forgot something.
And this is like a kind of like, I think one of the first like up close interactions she has with Shun after the first time they kind of like catch each other's eye at school.
And she has to go and quickly run that evening to go get this, whatever it is, fish or rice or something. Fish. And Shun happens to be driving by on his bike, and he drives her into town, and she gets there, and he buys her like a little snack. I don't remember exactly what it was. And that's the whole scene. And it just is, that's it. It's atmosphere, which animation's incredible for. I think people will look at, you know, in contrast, you said, Ghibli and anime in general is famous for fantastical elements. And people might ask, well, why would I want to watch an animated movie about regular life? Because
I said so. I said you should.
Because capturing a mood or an emotion, reality is not how we perceive it, and cameras flatten out reality. It's actually very, very difficult to capture what you want to, how you perceive it, how you imagine it. It's very hard to capture on camera, but animation is pure impression, pure emotion. It's almost like music. And so I think those moments it's really good at. I've talked for a while. Did you have another point you want to hit?
No, I kind of hit all my points.
That does kind of the impression, the kind of fictional element of it kind of transitions to something I do want to talk about, is I do feel the film is a little too idealistic. It kind of feels like people are a little too simple. It kind of, like, I just noticed when I was rewatching a little bit earlier today, everyone's like always smiling. It feels like almost like a very common theme in a lot of Ghibli films is like idealistic small town. And I'm totally fine with like a children's film being overly simplistic, because this is, you know, geared at a younger audience in general, because it's about younger people. Though actually, never mind. That makes me want to step back. It's about high schoolers and they feel young. Mm-hmm. And I respect the movie for that, because so many films make high schoolers feel like more like college kids, mm-hmm. rather than, so these people actually feel like 15 or 16 or 17 year olds. But that being said,
oh yeah, because they're talking about going to college.
Mm-hmm. I do feel the film is a little simplistic in its representation of life. I do feel if you want to, in my opinion, if you want to make a slice of life movie, it should go a little more toward representing reality a little bit more.
A little bit more into the conflict between the characters.
And I think specifically, Now, if the movie is subtly making a statement about this, then it went over my head, and I'll give the movie credit for that if it was doing that, which is possible. I get a little annoyed with, it feels to be totally okay with Umi's place in life, that she just cooks and takes care of everything, and it's just totally expected that her little brother doesn't help out at all. She cooks for her little brother. And I know Japan has different culture than us, and that's cool, and it's set in the 60s, but the movie doesn't seem very interested in making any sort of statement on she's more than just a young lady. Like even her grandmother says, I hope you find a man soon to take you off your father's. Like, it just, it...
We do also have, though, on the counter side, her mom is in America studying medicine.
That's true. But even then, I guess, like, the movie...
And one of the boarders is a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Though her grandma does get onto the border and say, well, why don't you marry another doctor and start a practice here? And she's like, I'm not going to do that.
But I would imagine that Umi's mom is only doing that because her husband died. But she didn't remarry. She took on her family. So yeah, I mean, the movie is not like overtly sexist, but I just felt like these are like, if most movies, if they're having these things happen in the first act where a character is like being like overwhelmed with something, later on, there might be some sort of, and again, it's less a life movie, but I do think there could be a little more reckoning with the fact that this character is just being expected to be away. That's unfair. It's not that, I'm not questioning that, you know, maybe if the Umi character wants to do all this, which she seems to want to, that's fine. It's that it's unfair expectations that the brother doesn't help, that she's expected to.
That is unfortunately true in some households here in America.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the other element was, I think the movie is sometimes a little understated, similar to the final exposition just kind of being thrown at us. It feels like a big part of Umi's character is that her mom's not around either. And then the mom just shows up out of nowhere with very little fanfare, and there's not, nothing comes of it. Like, there's not like a conversation. It doesn't feel like her mom showing up is a big moment in the movie. Like, as opposed to like anytime the father is around in The Boy and the Heron, it feels like a pretty big deal because the dad is kind of absent. Mm-hmm. These are not necessarily super bad things. These are things that I felt held back the movie, in my opinion. Just kind of some themes. Though, funny enough, about the movie maybe having some weird gender roles for Umi, a quote from Hayao Miyazaki about why they wanted to make this movie. "The hills of poppies care about the hearts of people. The girls and the boys of the work are pure and upright. They do not forget their dreams and do not disrespect the opposite sex." So it's weird, it's directly a quote about like gender equality, which I don't feel is there at all. Because that was the other thing is like,
maybe you also have, it's a silent take on how children do not come inherently biased against each other. They are taught that.
Yes. And it is incredibly possible that this is all the point of the movie that I'm missing.
Granted, you do have a moment where I think Allison kind of started to get into this before the movie showed it. The girls come to help clean.
Yes.
And I think you can make a point that's like, so the girls have to clean. You know, you're like, oh, so only the girls are going to clean. But in the next scene, you have a lot of the boys on their hands and knees, like hand scrubbing the floor. Maybe it's more of a joke that teenage boys don't know how to clean, which there's probably some truth to that.
Yeah.
But you do have that.
But then what we don't get is the girls being invited in to participate in all of the other things. But now that, to be fair, they are, the first time Umi and her sister enter, they are being constantly invited in. So that is
how do we make archaeology cool? Is probably one of the fun, is a very funny side conversation you overhear some side characters having.
My last bit I wanted to talk about is just to kind of transition into our next two episodes, is the involvement of Hayao Miyazaki into this movie. Because anytime you look it up on the internet, people are constantly kind of speculating on the relationship between Hayao Miyazaki, one of the greatest filmmakers in the world, and his son, Goro. And it does seem like Hayao Miyazaki very much, at least in the past, because anything we read is going to be outdated, because real-life human relationships develop and change.
Four or five times and come back.
But at the very least, when Goro was young, Hayao was very much absent from Goro's life. He was very involved with making of the movies. And the narrative, whether it's true or not, the narrative does seem to be that Goro, the only way he could get close to his father was to become an animator himself. But there was some barriers to that. So the first thing I have here is roughly a year before the film's release, the producer of the movie nearly removed Goro after being dissatisfied with the direction. During this time, Hayao Miyazaki offered to take over the movie if Goro was unable to fix the problems. Goro was given 3 days to come up with adjustments. On the third day, after receiving no new ideas, Hayao sent him a painting of the protagonist, I assume Umi, making huge strides on a bridge. This helped inform him that the issue was the character's lack of personalities and how he should alter it. Goro then presented these changes and was allowed to complete the film. So here we have, at least if the story is to be believed, which it was off IMDb trivia, which is notoriously inaccurate, is that it took Hayao being involved to save Garo from being kicked off the movie. And this actually, I'm just not realizing, relates to another quote I have, which is, and Hayao is a producer on the film. It's not like he's like butting in. He saw the initial sketches of the characters and felt that Umi was dark, dull, and soulless from the drawings, and was pretty much tried to force Goro to change the character. That seems to connect back to the quote I just read, which was Hayao did that ended up saving Goro from getting kicked off the film, was changing the character. Now, the question does exist of the version of Umi I'm kind of complaining about, was that a result of Goro being forced to change her? That's the kind of blank spots in her personality, the element around who she is was kind of forced upon him potentially. I don't know. Kind of some final quotes here. So as far as like the looming element of Hayao over the whole film, after the 2011 infamous earthquake and tsunami in Japan, it was announced that the film's production was affected by the rolling blackouts. However, Hayao Miyazaki assured the public that the film would be released on July 16th, 2011, as previously announced, saying that it was their responsibility to do so. So, again, Hayao forcing, see, from this quote at least, Hayao forcing the movie to be made and finished, even though there was the tsunami and the rolling blackouts, could also contribute to some of the maybe the lackluster elements of the movie. And finally, just a Hayao quote about Goro that I found very intriguing. I think Goro doesn't get it. It's okay for him to stop directing. I think he should. He isn't cut out for it. Wanting to do does something doesn't mean able to do. Directing isn't an easy job. You must push yourself until your nose starts bleeding and see what you create. Most people can't do it. Now, I do think that later on, Hayao softened up, whether for publicity reasons or his own heart softened. Because I did see a video of him actually complimenting Earwig and The Witches, which is 3D animated, which a lot of people have criticized looked terrible. I've not seen it myself, but people said that the Ghibli style does not translate into 3D, that the movie doesn't work. It did get poorly reviewed, but I did see a video of Hayao complimenting the movie. He in that video did say that Goro did figure out how to use CGI when he could not. So it is possible that Hayao has dramatically softened up on Goro as a director since then, but at the very least, according to this quote, at the time, Hayao did not have much confidence in Goro as the director of this movie. Yeah,
pretty scathing comment.
Yes. And it's interesting, this movie is about a father who's not there.
I know.
That's a huge part of the movie.
Two fathers that aren't there.
So to close this out, I actually have a moment, but it's not actually from the movie. It's from IMDb trivia. Quote, there's a lot of evidence that the movie takes place in 60s Japan. The song Sukiyaki plays in the background twice, which was released in 1961. And there are also posters for Tokyo's 1964 Olympics.
Wow.
Also, I'm pretty sure they talk about the Olympics multiple times.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure say the year, but the way that this is presented is
sounds
so
like
funny.
Are you sure you didn't find that on Reddit?
No, this was on IMDb at least.
So
that concludes our discussion of From Up on Poppy Hill. I'm glad that you like it so much. I appreciate you sharing it with me. I think it's beautifully animated. The performances are much stronger in the original version. I think it did give the characters a little more personality. I like the setting a lot. I like the atmosphere. And I would generally recommend it if that sounds good to you. It's not going to be for everyone, for sure.
Caleb enjoyed it, I think.
That's because he's in it.
Caleb just... Yeah, the first philosophy joke, I was like, yeah, I gotta watch this with Caleb. I do still want to watch When Marnie Was There with you and Allison at some
sure,
point.
Sure, totally. So now we transition to Meme Minute.
Aren't you glad I didn't pick Grave of the Fireflies?
What is that? That was weird. Your cup started like...
It was the metal straw against the glass.
It sounded like it was ready from... tea was ready. meme minute, but are the memes up on Poppy Hill?
Thank goodness.
I guess we'll climb to the top of the hill and see.
Thank goodness, this is meme minute. Did you say your hmm? You had a final hmm thought.
No, that was the trivia. Okay. Do you have any videos?
I do.
Okay, how many videos do you have?
They're all the same meme format.
Okay. Well, I'm going to show you one, then you can show me those. This is not an often commented on topic of this podcast, but it does come up occasionally. It's just the...
It's just Men at Work. That's the meme.
Yeah. It's the Men at Work song, Who Can It Be Now, which is famous for its saxophone. And it's just this image of... From I presume is a toy where children can make their own, like, it's not percussion, that's drums. What is, not woodwind, it's not wood.
That is a saxophone.
Yeah, but, like, what category?
They're a woodwind.
Saxophones? Even if it's not made out of wood?
Brass. I'm stupid. Megan, don't yell at me.
Yeah. Your own, like, what?
I'm stupid. Leave me alone. I just took Tylenol for my head hurty. Leave me alone.
Well,
it's
you can
the
make
heat
your
stroke.
Own sort of saxophony instrument.
I was thinking
out of
wood.
Tubes.
I was thinking, I mixed up because I was thinking they have wooden reeds.
Well, regardless, it's a picture of a little boy with this, like, toy saxophone made out of, like, tubes and stuff, and it just has this song playing. I thought it was very funny. Show me your videos, ma'am.
Okay, so I won't make us watch all three of them, but I will make us watch two of them. They're the exact same thing. They're about 40 seconds long.
Okay. 40 seconds?
Yes. And there's no dialogue, just music.
Well, those videos alone push it out of meme minute.
Just visual. Okay, so there's a trend right now, because there's a Snapchat filter that if you put it over someone's face, it gives you the Chad chin. And quirks an eyebrow up, a very smug look. It's the slang is called mogging.
Okay.
And someone did it to some Star Wars clips. This one is called Return of the Riz, and it kills me. At every single one of these stupid memes, I have to watch them. So I'm going to show you the first one, which is from Return of the Jedi. Hold on.
You got brain rot, Rachel.
I like cry every time I see one of these because
why is this 40 seconds?
Anyway, so that was the good one is the Anakin one.
It's a little better.
So here's
a little funnier.
So here's the thing.
It goes from a 0 to a 1.
So here's the thing. This is not 40 seconds. Oh no, it is 40 seconds. I'm dumb.
Just setting up my hopes just to crush them back down.
So someone did it for The Acolyte, and it's perfect.
Okay.
This is probably the best Acolyte media I've ever seen. It's the same music, so sorry for those that are visual. I retweeted it on our Twitter, so if you see it, that's where you can look.
Plug. Oh, my God.
It kills me every single... It's the eyebrow.
It does match...
It is the eyebrows that kill me every single time.
What? I'm totally... Chimere. It does match Chimere.
It matches Chimere. Oh, my God. It's just...
I hate it so much.
This one had me in tears. It's just so funny. I retweeted it. Go view it. It's gold. my favorite for at Keldor Jedi posted it and just said, I'm so sorry. Anyways, I won't make you sit through the Phantom Menace one.
So this is an edit that someone made for themselves, just kind of playing around with visual effects. So he...
I know exactly who this is.
He pulled the sun out of the sky, put it in his pocket, and it got dark. Also, Linkin Park makes it relevant.
I see this guy all the time. I love his stuff.
And he's walking, and like the sky is like a black hole. There's a galaxy shooting lightning out of his hands. He's looking in the mirror. He turns around. The mirror is still looking at him with a fire in his hands.
He's standing on a dock, and a Star Destroyer shows up.
He's too powerful. I've seen this one. Cameron, when he insults me for brain rot, but this is also very brain rot.
Look, at least it's double related to the podcast. Actually, I hadn't watched past the Star Destroyer part. I don't know if there's anything good after that. Oh, yeah, he fills up a coffee mug.
My favorite thing is how the comments just hype him up. Yeah. Because I feel like it'd be very easy for the internet to do what the internet does best, which is unfortunately bullying. I just love it.
How many memes do you have?
Well, I don't know how to count.
That's unfortunate. That's why you didn't know how many seconds your videos
were. I have 9.
Okay, I have 10, so I'm going to show you this other video then. This is an ad. So one of my favorite like kind of trends and just like people posting is like the insane amount of marketing for the Phantom Menace. And it's just an endless treasure trove.
I know. They had so many good...
Oh, Rachel's reaction was priceless.
She just morphs into literally Padme with all the makeup and big headdress. Like, it's not like they dress up the actress when playing the mom. She literally morphs into a still image of Padme. It is bizarre. It really caught me off guard, man. Really caught me off guard. Okay. Memes. we're bringing it back.
Oh, you're showing me too.
The myth of consensual sex. Chimere, I consent. Osha, I consent. Plagueis, I don't.
I don't.
Isn't there someone you forgot to ask?
Oh, man. Are you ready for a censor?
Sure. Write this down, Athena. She's in position. She's ready.
I'm not just the dad that stepped up. I'm the dad that f***ed up. It's a picture of Soul and Osha. Actually, no, it's May in the background. It's the image of when he turns around and realizes Osha was there when he said he killed their mom.
It's a still frame of Yoda's little cameo from
The Acolyte.
From The Acolyte. And it just says, wow, they have an old Grogu in The Acolyte.
I've seen that one.
Seems like an obvious joke, but I had not thought of it or heard of it.
Adding another character to the list of dead Star Wars dads, the picture of the Grim Reaper knocking on doors with his scythe, and they're all open with a blood trail.
We've got Jango.
Owen, Jango, Galen, Erso, Bail, Arcana, Kanan, Jarrus, and then Soul.
Except for Owen, Galen, Bail, and Kanan were good guys who didn't deserve it. Jango was always a villain.
But he looked cool.
It's true.
He loved his son.
This
clone.
Is just a purely visual meme.
Oh.
What would you say the joke here is?
That's Starscream.
It's Starscream.
I know. I'm not stupid. I've been on the internet.
It's Starscream, but it's not Starscream. It's a Dorito with a pilot helmet on, a fighter pilot helmet on, skull arms and chicken legs.
I don't know what you're talking about. That's Baber Starscream. That's just a picture of him.
The whole joke.
Corporate would like to find
you. Baber Starscream is so triangular in his shape.
I almost said he's square. He's not square. He's just triangle.
Yeah, the other one, Rachel.
So a meme. Your parents are disappointed in you. Rolling eyes. Stock image. Optimus Prime is disappointed in you. Man crying.
Very good. I like it. Another visual meme.
Oh, okay. Weird Wallace and Gromit niche. All right.
It's Leia and Han on Endor when they were captured by the Empire. They got their arms behind their back. But and then what is it's implied it's cutting to the other angle. It is the Penguin from Wallace and Gromit with a gun on them. It's so silly. It's so simple. I really appreciate it.
That's Athena's editing pose.
What do you got next? Wow.
It's a crying Commander Rex Wojak meme. No, the chip makes me do it. I can't control my actions. And a Chad phase 2 clone trooper. Yeah. What I remember about the rise of the Empire is how quiet it was. During the waning hours of the Clone Wars, the 501st Legion was discreetly transferred back to Coruscant. It was a silent trip. We all knew what was about to happen, what we were about to do. Did we have any doubts? Any private, traitorous thoughts? Perhaps, but no one said a word. Not on the flight to Coruscant. Not when Order 66 came down. And not when we marched into the Jedi Temple. Not a word.
Not a word.
Which is... you know, a
infamous montage from the clone campaign from the original Battlefront 2.
Yeah.
Which is
voiced
actual
by
actual Temuera Morrison voice.
Morrison.
Oh my gosh. If you've never played that, I do recommend just watching the like cutscenes from that campaign are all just
absolutely a moving monologue
just,
from him.
Every one of them is just Temuera Morrison doing like a journal entry from the perspective of a clone, and that's obviously the best one. Oh, so
and
good.
It's a reference,
a very good joke,
because before Clone Wars they just did it.
Yep.
They got the order and they said, all right, pack it up everybody, and then Clone Wars added it was a fail safe chip. I think to make the clones more sympathetic to them.
Oh,
they just turn.
Yeah, you can't have all of, now I would have been down for it, but you can't have a children's show all about the Clone Wars, where they humanize all the clones, and at the end, they just willfully murder the Jedi.
So, off topic, the way Athena is sitting right now gives me an idea that I think she's a little warm. She's very splooted out.
This is a very consistent, ongoing joke, but I think it will take a long time for it to stop being funny. When an Imperial falls off a railless catwalk... Does the name OSHA mean anything to you? What was it? That last part was an actual quote by Vernestra.
That was a good one. That's a good one. I'll have her back home by 8 p.m., sir. Your daughter calls me daddy, too.
Uh-huh.
And it's Manny, I've just forgot her last name.
Patinko?
I don't think that's right.
Okay. I don't know.
And, the
Manny
actor.
Manny Patinkin is a different actor.
Yeah, you're right. It's like on the tip of my tongue.
Jacinto. I was not that far off.
I was like, starts with a J.
Manny Jacinto,
yes. Who plays Chimer in The Acolyte, and he is also in The Good Place.
Mm-hmm.
So The Good Place character.
Much a smiley, brighter
smiley
character. Looks nothing.
Monk.
Like, yeah.
I have him back home by 8 p.m. and then shirtless Chimer. Your daughter calls me daddy too.
It is my sleepover. I get to choose the movie.
Oh my god.
And it's Link from Legend of Zelda holding up Shin Godzilla.
Oh my gosh. picture Qui-Gon Jinn appears randomly out of the desert. I'm not here to free the slaves. Manipulates local economy with magic. Hits on single moms. Takes child's blood without consent. Encourages illegal gambling. Steals child.
So good.
And it's buff shirtless Qui-Gon. I think it's a John Cena image.
Edit. My high school has the worst mascot ever.
I hate that.
Who is it, Rachel?
Basil. Roadkill when I'm done with him. Died 1995, born 1996. Welcome back, the King of the Monsters. Picture Millennium, burning Godzilla, and
I'm blanking on her name too.
Oh my gosh, me too. Names are so bad. Frick.
Zendaya.
I was like, what's her last name?
Text message conversation. Why do you like this movie so much? And it's Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. Whichever one that is. It's a poster.
I'm so glad you asked.
I'm so glad you asked. 6 hours.
2 minutes voice memo.
If this meme does not represent this podcast, I don't know what does.
Why do you like the hyperspace jump so much? I'm so glad you asked. Why do you like Andor music so much? I'm so glad you asked. Girls, when they get a compliment, thank you. 1960s Godzilla.
Just... Wow, very happy looking Godzilla. Yeah, he's got his mouth open, his arms out. Imagine drunk driving this MF. it's General Grievous's like wheel bike.
me waiting by the window watching the delivery driver walk up to my door. It's very nice. Like it's peeking around the wall.
Very nice.
That's it. So I got Cameron.
This is my last one.
How did you have more than me?
Obi-Wan Kenobi living under a fascist regime that purged everyone he loved. The guys in this airport bar are the worst people in the universe. He called whenever they first get to Tatooine episode 4. He says, most icy spaceport, the most wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Can you repeat that?
Obi-Wan Kenobi living under a fascist regime that purged everyone he loves.
Oh, quote, okay.
The guys in this airport bar are the worst people in the universe.
Okay. Sorry, I was just like, oh. Oh, it took me a little second. Took a little bit to render in my head for me. Oh, we got crunchies.
So this is the portion of Meme Minute where we each guess what meme the other one made.
Shmeme Schminute.
And I'm going to bring up the scores.
Cameron, send me your memes.
I did.
No, you didn't.
I just texted them to you.
No, you didn't.
Are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
Are you absolutely sure? Mm-hmm. Well, something went very wrong then because I hit send.
Whose fault is that?
That's very weird. I don't know what happened. Probably because I received yours at the same time and it just forced it to.
Mm. You know, while we're waiting for Cameron to send me his memes.
I tried.
Look, hey, the table's turned. Let me capitalize on this.
Okay. They just sent. Now you have two versions of them.
Oh, okay. Do I get two guesses?
Why would you
get... I was making a joke.
Oh, ha, 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 ha.
They have an old Grogu. I feel like the Starscream Dorito is a little niche for you, honestly. You're not that big of a Transformers fan.
Gotta make sure I'm looking at the right memes. Okay, we've got I'm Not the Dad That Stepped Up. Dead Dads. Your Parents Are Disappointed in You. The Order 66 chip. Your daughter calls me daddy too. Died, born. Goes and they compliment me waiting by the window, watch the delivery driver walk up to my door. I have two, three. I am going to guess this Godzilla one.
Yeah.
Girls, when they get a compliment. Thank you. 1960s Godzilla. Ah, it's good. I like it. It's cute. We're on week 33 of the game. I improved to 18 and 17, just over 0.500. Rachel, you are currently at 18 and 14.
I should make sure I have the... Oh, sorry. I actually opened up my Twitter to the Mog meme of the Acolyte. I was crying when I was watching that. I'm not going to lie. I saw it late at night. I was like freaking crying my eyes. I was so funny. I was losing it. I was absolutely dying. That was hilarious.
While Rachel is deciding what her guess is, I will thank Caleb Jacoby for our intro and outro music. And I'll thank Rachel for our artwork and Twitter account at Rebels Robots Pod.
I'm torn between two. I think. Athena, what do you think? You do like Wallace and Gromit. You have made quite a few consensual sex memes.
Wow, I hate that statement out of context.
And I'm right. That's what I'm going to post on the Twitter this week. That's it. No link to the podcast, just that. You know, I think I'm going to go with it. Did you make this Dorito thing?
I did not make the Dorito one. I wish I had. I think it's really funny. I made the one...
Actually, I have to remind myself. I made the my high school as the worst mascot ever.
Oh, I hate that.
And I added that it's tweeted by Jackie.
That's good. That was in depth. I didn't want to point
that out in the moment because
I saw it.
Okay, good.
I've seen a lot of memes in this format, so yeah. I was surprised.
I've saved that meme format for a while because I knew it'd be funny. I just wanted to wait till I had this perfect joke.
Dislike.
Thank you to Athena for doing our editing, as always. Not sure exactly how much work she does, but, you know. Let us know if you watched from up on Poppy Hill. Let us know if you're into it or not. And next time, we will be back in 2 weeks for my choice, which is Princess Mononoke. A very different movie. A movie that is almost dramatically opposite on the other side of everything about what it could... Everything that From Up on Poppy Hill is or isn't, as far as Ghibli films go, Ghibli. Princess Mononoke is the opposite.
Ghibli.
This is Cameron and Rachel signing off, saying this podcast has the worst mascot ever.
No. How dare you put her at that same level? She's at least nice to look at.
I don't know. I think she looks kind of like Basil.
Yeah, this is our retirement episode. We're not doing this again.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Oh.
I can tell when she starts to rear up.